Imagine spending like your entire career, decades of your life, basically acting as the ultimate hype man for the digital revolution.
Right.
You know, you're the one walking into these massive corporations, laying out the blueprints for how to use every shiny new piece of tech to just completely crush the
No.
competition.
Yeah, the classic Silicon Valley playbook.
Exactly. And then seemingly overnight, you realize the real problem isn't the software anymore. It's like whether society itself is going to even survive the upgrade.
It's a profound shift in perspective, for sure.
Yeah.
But you spend 30 years optimizing systems for maximum profit, and then, well, you hit a wall.
Yeah.
You realize that optimizing a supply chain literally doesn't matter if, the supply chain is physically underwater due to climate change.
Right, or if the whole political system governing it has just totally collapsed.
Exactly.
Which is it's kind of like being hired to install this state-of-the-art multi-million-dollar sound system in a house, right? And as you're wiring the living room, you realize the actual foundation of the house is actively sinking into a sinkhole.
That is exactly it. The tech upgrade becomes totally irrelevant compared to the structural integrity of the building itself.
And that is exactly where we are starting today's deep dive. So we're looking at a really fascinating, highly detailed transcript of a recent sit-down conversation between two veteran heavyweights in the world of future forecasting.
Right, Gerd Leonhard and Joe Codron.
Yep. And our mission today is to unpack their blueprint for how Europe and realistically, I mean, any society caught in the middle of our fracturing global order can kind of regain its technological sovereignty. Basically, how to stop playing a geopolitical game that it's fundamentally destined to lose.
And, the reason this specific source text carries so much weight is really the background of the speakers.
Yeah, they're not just theorists.
No, not at all. Joe Codron has spent, what, 33 years in the digital space? He founded over 25 companies, built Belgium's very first web agency.
Wow.
And Gerd Leonhard is a globally recognized futurist. He's advised dozens of Fortune 500 companies. So these aren't politicians making campaign promises.
Right, and they aren't academics theorizing from some ivory tower.
Exactly. They are tech insiders who are looking at the data and openly admitting that technology is just no longer the primary driver of global disruption.
Now, real quick, before we get into the actual mechanics of their blueprint, I do need to make a quick but important note for you listening regarding the source material.
Yeah, this is a crucial point.
Because the conversation we're analyzing today gets into some deeply politically charged territory. The speakers offer pretty pointed critiques of US political figures, the American conservative movement, the Chinese government, all of it.
They definitely pull no punches.
They really don't.
Yeah.
So, just to be completely clear up front, we are not taking sides here. We're not endorsing any of these political viewpoints on this deep dive.
Right. We're just the messengers.
Exactly. Our goal is strictly to impartially report on and analyze the arguments and strategies exactly as these two futurists presented them in the original video.
Which is a necessary foundation to establish, because in their worldview, the political analysis and the technological strategy are completely intertwined.
You can't untangle them.
No, you really can't address the technology without addressing the geopolitical reality that governs it.
So let's start with the kind of micro crisis these two experts are experiencing in their own day-to-day careers, because I think it perfectly illustrates the massive macro crisis they say Europe is facing right now.
Yeah, they're basically both dealing with a professional existential crisis,
Yeah.
regarding what a futurist even does anymore.
Totally. They describe this very distinct shift in their consulting work. Like 5 or 10 years ago, a major bank or a retail brand would hire them with a super straightforward mandate.
Right. Something like, tell us how to use AI to get more sales.
Exactly. Build as a digital transformation strategy. But today, I mean, digital transformation is basically table stakes. Everyone has a digital strategy.
Yeah, you can't just sell an app anymore.
Right.
Codron talks about a year-long project he recently did for BNP Paribas, which is a massive European bank.
Okay, yeah.
He went in to do a standard digital disruption strategy, mapping out the next 5 years of tech integration. But as they were mapping it out, they just hit this absolute wall of societal drivers.
What do you mean by societal drivers exactly?
Well, they realized they had to account for things like an aging population, which completely changes the labor force.
Yeah.
And they had to account for a housing affordability crisis that fundamentally alters consumer borrowing.
Oh, wow. So the actual demographics of their customers.
Exactly. Plus, they had to factor in climate change and the stark reality that certain physical assets literally won't be insurable in a decade.
Right.
So the technology suddenly took a back seat to the outright survival and stability of the society the bank actually operates in.
Which totally shifts the whole conversation, because it's a pivot from asking, what can we have, to what do we want?
For decades, the tech industry has just been driven by pure capability. Like, if we can build it, we should build it.
And we'll just figure out the consequences later.
Exactly. Move fast and break things. But now, these futurists are arguing that we have to stop and intentionally ask what kind of future we actually desire.
Which is, frankly, a deeply philosophical conversation.
It is. And it's a much, much harder conversation to have in a corporate boardroom that's, you know, heavily focused on quarterly returns.
Oh, for sure. And that reluctance in the boardroom is perfectly captured by this wild anecdote Leonhard shares in the text. This blew my mind.
Oh, the AI scripts?
Yes. So clients are currently using AI tools to predict future market trends, right? But then they are actually using those same tools to write scripts for Leonhard to deliver at his own keynotes.
It's so dystopian.
It really is. He's showing up to speak, and they're just handing him a fully synthesized AI-generated speech about the future.
Yeah.
I mean, if an AI can accurately predict the tech trends and write the speeches, human futurists become totally obsolete if they just stick to the data.
Right. If your entire value proposition is just forecasting trends, an AI can do that faster and at a massive scale.
So they're forced to shift from being like service providers to being advocates for a human-centric future.
The human value in consulting now has to be about values, ethics, and advocacy. But as Codron and Leonhard note, bringing inherently social and political issues into a corporate setting really rocks the boat.
Yeah, I bet.
They mention that when they speak to CEOs privately, those executives fully acknowledge all the macro threats.
The climate risks, the geopolitics.
All of it. But those same CEOs struggle to translate those macro threats into actual company strategy.
Because of the shareholders.
Exactly. The immense unyielding pressure from shareholders who only care about the next 90 days of profit.
So this realization that society desperately needs to figure out what we want rather than just what we can buy leads directly into what they see as Europe's current geopolitical wake-up call.
Right. And they frame Europe's current situation as this highly messy, highly stressful uncoupling from the United States.
Yeah, they actually refer to it as the transatlantic divorce.
It's a great term.
It really is. They argue that for the last 20 years, Europe just took the path of least resistance. It was just easier, right? You outsource all the messy, expensive, heavy manufacturing to China.
Right.
And then whenever a European startup has a great tech idea, you immediately look to the U.S. for venture capital funding and your go-to-market strategy.
But the geopolitical winds are shifting rapidly right now. The U.S. is fundamentally changing its national security strategies. They're turning much more protectionist.
Yeah, the TPS Act, tariffs, all of that.
Exactly. And Europe is suddenly waking up to the fact that their lifelines might just be cut off entirely.
Because the source material highlights that the U.S. is actively signaling a desire for Europe to follow its cultural and political lead, essentially asking Europe to align much more closely with American foreign policy.
And the underlying threat there is that if Europe decides it wants to chart its own course, you know, economically or technologically, that U.S. support structure they've relied on for decades might just vanish.
Which brings up this phenomenal metaphor from Codron. So he recently published a book with a rather blunt title, Fuck the System and Other Bad Ideas for the Future.
Very catchy.
Yeah, and in it, he compares Europe to a 24-year-old teenager whose parents just abruptly cut off their allowance.
It's so accurate, though. Europe has basically been living in the basement, super comfortable, letting someone else pay the major bills for defense and tech scaling.
And now they're being forced to move out and get a real job.
Yeah, it's a harsh diagnosis.
Damn.
But let's look at the actual capabilities of this 24-year-old.
Mm.
Because the text is very clear that Europe isn't broke.
No, not at all.
And they certainly aren't untalented.
Yeah.
They have all the fundamental building blocks to be an absolute superpower.
Right. They specifically mention ASML. And for anyone listening who might be unfamiliar, ASML is a Dutch company, and they are arguably the most important tech company on earth that the average person has never heard of.
Oh, absolutely.
They hold a global monopoly on extreme ultraviolet lithography machines, which basically these are machines that use lasers to print intricate circuitry onto microchips at the atomic level.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing tech.
It really is. You literally cannot manufacture the most advanced AI chips in the world without ASML's machines.
Right.
Furthermore, Europe has this top-tier tech talent pouring out of institutions like ETH, Zurich in Switzerland.
Right.
So if they have the monopoly on the chip making machines and they have all this engineering talent, why haven't they moved out of the basement yet?
Well, Caudron and Leon Hard point to a profound lack of confidence and a severe deficit in risk-taking.
Interesting.
Europe has all the academic brilliance, all the incredible engineering infrastructure, but they completely lack that Darwinian, highly aggressive entrepreneurial hustle that completely defines the American venture capital system.
So they've essentially outsourced the most crucial step of the innovation pipeline, like taking the breakthrough from the university lab and actually scaling it to the consumer market. But if they lack that American Darwinian hustle, how do you inject urgency into a system that's been so comfortable in the basement for 20 years?
The speakers argue that the solution is actually the pain of the current moment.
Pain as therapy.
Yes. This geopolitical shock, along with economic crises like the devastating collapse we're seeing right now in the German automotive industry, is the painful therapy Europe desperately needs.
It's forcing European leaders to realize that just being a market project where 27 different countries agree to trade goods with low tariffs, it's just no longer sufficient for survival.
Right. They have to mature overnight and become a true United States of Europe.
A state project, not just an economic zone. And Leon Harkin, who actually lives in Switzerland, points to the Swiss cantonal system as a potential blueprint for how a united Europe could function without losing all those diverse cultural identities.
And the mechanics of the Swiss system are really fascinating when you try to apply them to a macro level. The idea is that you don't try to erase the individual cultures of France or Germany or Portugal.
Well, nobody wants that.
Exactly. Instead, you pool your sovereignties, much like the Swiss cantons do. In Switzerland, the individual cantons keep their own local laws and utilize direct democracy. They vote on highly localized issues every 3 months.
But they share a highly efficient, streamlined federal structure for the things that actually matter globally.
Right, like defense.
Yeah. Leonhard notes that the Swiss federal defense budget is incredibly efficient, sitting at just 0.88% of their GDP. Yet they maintain this highly resilient national defense.
It's a model of how a continent could be united and formidable on the global stage without turning into some monolithic bureaucracy that just crushes local culture.
Okay, so assuming Europe can pull itself together, assuming this 24-year-old gets a job, pools resources with some roommates, and starts acting like an independent adult, the immediate unavoidable question they face is how to handle the single biggest technological boom of our lifetime.
Artificial intelligence.
And this is where Caudron and Leon Hard make their most controversial claim. They argue that Europe's very first instinct regarding AI is completely 100% wrong.
Yeah, Europe's instinct right now is to just join the AI arms race.
Right. They want to throw billions of euros at building a European frontier model that can somehow beat OpenAI's ChatGPT. Or they want to race the US and China in building autonomous AI-driven drone swarms.
And the speakers consider that a colossal, pointless waste of capital and intellectual resources.
Really? A complete waste?
Totally. They argue that chasing this concept of an AI god, or leaning into singularitarian transhumanism, you know, this idea that humans must eventually merge with machines to stay relevant, is a highly specific, highly localized Silicon Valley ideology.
Okay.
Yeah. It's heavily pushed by techno-optimists and ultra-capitalists, but they argue it's fundamentally disconnected from what average citizens actually want. Not just in Europe, but they argue the average citizen in the U.S. doesn't want that either.
See, I want to test this logic for a second, because for you listening, dropping out of a technological arms race probably sounds incredibly dangerous.
It does sound counterintuitive.
Right. If Europe completely abandons the frontier AI race, if they explicitly state they are not going to try and build the biggest, smartest AI model in the world, don't they just resign themselves to being a permanent digital colony?
I see what you mean.
It feels a bit like deciding to drop out of the space race because you'd rather focus on building really nice telescopes on the ground. Like, how does Europe maintain any geopolitical leverage if they are permanently a year or two behind the absolute cutting edge?
Well, the speakers address this by drawing a vital distinction between frontier capabilities and real-world implementation.
Okay, unpack that for me.
Sure. Think about a European-built AI model like Mistral. Let's assume Mistral is a full year behind OpenAI in frontier development.
Right. So the peak of what it can theoretically do in a pristine lab environment is 12 months behind the American equivalent.
Exactly. And in the grand scheme of an arms race, being 12 months behind is a lifetime. you lose the race.
Wait, so you're saying the gap between a brand new AI model and a one-year-old AI model might matter a ton to a software developer in Silicon Valley, but it's basically completely invisible to a logistics company mapping trucking routes in Berlin.
Precisely. For a normal business trying to use AI to streamline its supply chain, or, you know, a labor union trying to analyze contracts to improve worker conditions, or a public school system personalizing education plans, the real-world performance gap between a model that is 1 year old and a brand-new trillion-parameter model is practically zero.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
The older model is already vastly more capable than what the institution currently utilizes.
So the race Europe actually needs to run is not the frontier race. It is the implementation race.
Yes. And you have to consider the demographic reality here. Europe has a rapidly aging population.
Right. Birth rates are dropping everywhere.
There are simply not enough young people entering the workforce to support the broader economy and the pension systems over the next two decades. Their economic productivity has to increase dramatically just to maintain their current standard of living.
So if Europe takes the hundreds of billions of euros they would have wasted trying to beat Google and Microsoft at building an AI god.
Exactly.
And instead, they focus all of that capital purely on integrating existing, slightly older AI models deeply into their traditional industries, their healthcare systems, their educational infrastructure. They win the race that actually matters.
Because they boost productivity enough to offset their demographic collapse.
It's not about having the flashiest tool. It's about being the society that embeds the tool most effectively into everyday life.
Right.
So if they are consciously stepping away from the AI arms race, what exactly is the strategic game plan for establishing this new era of European sovereignty?
They outline a very specific two-pronged strategy. And the first prong is dominating what they call transition sector.
Transition sector.
Yeah, these are the massive foundational shifts in human infrastructure that just have to happen regardless of which political party is in power.
With energy being the primary example.
Oh, absolutely.
Because right now, energy is heavily treated as a commodity. You dig fossil fuels out of the ground. There's inherent physical scarcity. Prices fluctuate wildly based on global events. And most importantly, it's constantly used as a geopolitical weapon to hold entire continents hostage.
Which is a dynamic Europe knows all too well, given recent history with Russia.
Right. So the strategy here is to heavily invest in making energy a technology rather than a commodity.
Exactly. Because when you focus on solar or wind or wave energy, you are dealing with technology. And technology tends to follow Moore's law.
Just like computer chips, every 2 years, the technology gets smaller, cheaper, and vastly more efficient.
Yes. So if Europe focuses its immense engineering talent on accelerating that technological curve for energy, they argue that in 15 or 20 years, they achieve total energy independence.
And the biggest geopolitical weapon historically used against them, literally cutting off the fuel supply, simply vanishes.
Exactly. And they apply this exact same logic to other transition sectors, too. They point to the protein transition in food, moving away from incredibly resource-heavy traditional livestock farming toward lab-grown or plant-based alternatives.
Right, because food security is another massive vulnerability.
And they also highlight shared autonomous mobility. Instead of a future where every single European owns an $80,000 electric car that just sits parked and unused 95% of the time, you transition to highly efficient, shared autonomous fleets.
So they're choosing to compete in the infrastructure of the new world rather than fighting over the resources of the old world.
Right.
But this is where their digital strategy takes a massive left turn, because they also want to reclaim their digital sovereignty using what they call a copyback strategy.
This part is fascinating.
It really is. They introduced this wild concept for something they call Europe Online, which is essentially a proposition to create a massive, public, entirely ad-free European social media platform.
With the explicit goal being to break the algorithmic black holes of platforms like TikTok and X, which they view as fundamentally incompatible with a healthy democracy.
No, when I first read that, my immediate thought was about the sheer mechanics of it. I mean, is it actually possible to just reverse engineer Facebook or Twitter?
It sounds impossible at first glance.
Right. Doesn't the platform with the most users always win because of the network effect? Like, why would anyone leave an established network for a government-backed clone?
And this is where the mechanics of the copyback strategy become incredibly pragmatic. Codron points out that you do not need to rewrite 20 years of complex proprietary code to build a functional social network.
You really don't.
No, you really only need to copy the 15 or so core features that people actually use daily. Posting text, sharing photos, direct messaging, forming groups. The technology to do this flawlessly already exists in open protocols.
So for you listening, think of open protocols kind of like email. You can use a Gmail account and I can use an Outlook account, but we can still message each other perfectly because the underlying pipes connecting us are public and standardized.
Exactly.
And that's what they want to do for social media, utilizing existing open structures like the AT protocol, which currently powers platforms like Blueski.
The technological barrier to entry is virtually zero. The real barrier, as you mentioned, is the network effect. Actually, getting millions of people to log on and create the community.
Right.
And this is where their proposed solution is genuinely outside the box. They propose utilizing the one massive advantage Europe still has, its traditional public media companies.
Oh, this is so smart. Because the public broadcasters and legacy newspapers still reach hundreds of millions of European citizens every single day.
Right. So imagine if every major public broadcaster, every national television station and every major newspaper in Europe simultaneously pushed Europe Online at the end of every single article and every evening news broadcast.
Just a massive unified front.
If they all adopted a unified message saying, hey, continue the conversation with our journalists, our artists, and your neighbors on this secure, ad-free public platform.
Wow.
They could leverage Europe's massive 450 million person market to forcibly engineer a network effect.
It would essentially be the biggest, most coordinated advertising campaign in human history and run entirely for free by the public media infrastructure.
Exactly.
And the authors point out that this copyback transition is already quietly gaining momentum in other tech sectors. Like citizens and municipal governments across Europe are already beginning to switch to European-hosted cloud services like Nextcloud. And they are utilizing platforms like Proton for encrypted email instead of relying on Google. The moment a few major European governments mandate that all their civil servants switch to sovereign European tech for daily operations, the service providers have to scale up to meet that demand, and the snowball just starts rolling down the hill.
It is a highly ambitious plan, but it fundamentally reframes digital infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
It treats the digital public square as a vital public good, much like public highways or public broadcasting.
Rather than treating it as a private playground designed solely to harvest user data for ad revenue.
Exactly.
So, okay, we have all the pieces on the board. Europe has the underlying talent. They have institutions like ETH Zurich and ASML. They have this incredibly clever implementation race strategy for AI, and they have the open protocol copyback strategy.
The blueprint is there.
Right. But if all of this is so clear to these experts, why isn't this grand European revival already dominating global headlines? Like, why does the average citizen still feel so incredibly gloomy about Europe's future?
Because, as Codron and Leonhard put it, Europe has a massive fundamental branding problem.
They literally joke in the text that European institutional communication looks like a poorly designed website from 1999.
It's harsh but true.
Yeah.
The bureaucratic institutions in Brussels are fantastic at defining complex architecture, you know, writing incredibly detailed legislation, and allocating vast sums of funding.
But they are notoriously terrible at storytelling.
They completely lack pan-European public intellectuals.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at the U.S., you have dozens of household names, entrepreneurs, podcasters, authors, who are constantly shaping the public narrative about where technology is taking us.
Yeah, the Elon Musks and the Lex Fridmans of the world.
Right. But in Europe, because you're dealing with 27 different countries and dozens of different languages, thought leadership is highly fragmented and localized.
So they know exactly how to implement these changes, but they have absolutely no idea how to explain to the public why they should endure the friction of these massive transitions.
Precisely.
I really loved Leonhard's concept here. He started a campaign called I Love the Future. And he argues that Europe's historic tendency, specifically calling out the traditional German engineering mindset, is to basically build the perfect machine first and only figure out the narrative for it after it's finished.
Which is a catastrophic failure of psychology when you are asking millions of people to fundamentally alter how they live, how they eat, and how they travel.
Absolutely. Think about the mechanics of political resentment here for a second. If you're a European farmer, and Brussels is hands down a highly complex, perfectly engineered piece of climate legislation that forces you to completely change your livelihood and your daily operations.
Right.
But they offer you absolutely no positive vision of what your life will actually look like on the other side of that change. Of course you are naturally going to resist it.
You're building this perfectly regulated, sovereign digital and environmental machine, But you haven't given the citizens a single reason why they would actually want to drive it.
And the text points out that this narrative void is exactly why populism and reactionary politics are rising so sharply right now across the continent. Millennials and younger generations feel hopeless about Europe's direction, so they naturally turn to the politicians offering the simplest, loudest anger.
And to explain how a narrative can actually fix that deep structural societal anxiety, they reference Kim Stanley Robinson's science fiction novel, The Ministry for the Future.
Oh, yeah. Great book.
They argue Europe quite literally needs a minister for the future because the psychological reality is that human beings basically only change their behavior for two reasons: pain or love.
And right now, Europe is experiencing the pain. I mean, they're feeling the economic shocks of the German car industry slowing down. They're feeling the geopolitical isolation of the U.S. pulling away. And they're feeling the friction of climate mandates.
But pain only breeds resentment and political backlash if there isn't a positive vision to move toward. They need the love.
They need a compelling, highly accessible, almost populist story that paints a vivid, attractive picture of what European life, food, and mobility will actually look like in 2050 if they get this transition right.
Exactly. Because without that deeply positive narrative, the public will fight the required technological and environmental changes every single step of the way.
So to tie this entire blueprint together for you listening, we started with two seasoned futurists who realized that merely hyping up corporate AI tools was just no longer viable.
Because the structural survival of society itself is now on the table.
Right. We explored Europe's highly stressful but entirely necessary divorce from its reliance on U.S. infrastructure, which is forcing the continent to finally move out of the basement and act like an independent adult.
And we examined the deliberate strategic choice to abandon the unwinnable frontier AI arms race.
Choosing instead to focus all that capital on an implementation race that integrates existing AI into supply chains and healthcare to offset an aging demographic.
We also broke down the mechanics of turning energy into a technology that follows Moore's law.
Alongside using open protocols for a copyback strategy to reclaim digital sovereignty with platforms like A Public Europe Online. All of which ultimately hinges on Europe finally learning how to tell a compelling story about tomorrow.
It is a comprehensive, if incredibly challenging, blueprint. But before we wrap up today's deep dive, there's one final thought that naturally emerges from these strategies. Something for you to mull over as you watch these geopolitical shifts play out in the news.
Let's hear it.
If Europe actually manages to successfully execute this blueprint, if they flat out reject the Silicon Valley model of transhumanism, and they successfully build thriving, publicly owned social networks using open protocols.
Yeah.
And if they strictly regulate AI purely as a tool for human benefit rather than corporate dominance, they might not just save themselves. By creating a highly regulated, human-centric tech ecosystem for 450 million wealthy consumers, could Europe accidentally force the rest of the world to adopt their standards simply to maintain access to that massive market?
Oh, wow. The Brussels effect on steroids.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What if, in the 21st century, the ultimate global superpower isn't the nation that invents the most advanced technology, but the nation that writes the foundational rules on how humanity is allowed to use it.
The rulemaker as the ultimate superpower. I love that. It brings us right back to the central realization of our two futurists, you know? Maybe the most important innovation of our time isn't the software upgrade itself, but ensuring that human society survives the upgrade on our own terms.
Couldn't have said it better.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the narratives and the mechanisms behind the technology you use every day, and we'll see you next time.